Welcome to Casa de Cambio. This is episode 10 and the final episode of season 7 of the podcast. And I have left the best until last. With me today, all the way from Sydney, I have Andrew Buto. Welcome, Andrew.
Hey, thanks, Natasha. Thanks for having me on board.
How are you today? How's your day been?
Day's been fabulous, as it always is. I think there's been some ups, there's been some downs, but overall, really positive going into 2023.
Wonderful. I had an excellent day. We were talking about this. It's put me in a really good mood because some days as a business owner, you're like, why am I doing this? And today was it was a good day. What? Because I started the day with Sharon Connolly's networking breakfast.
Oh, she's here fantastic. In Melbourne.
It was amazing. And I saw a lot of people in the change community that I hadn't seen in person for a while. And I met some amazing people who I've connected with online in person today. And one of those people gave me a bottle of champagne.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, I mean, you've had a way better day than me.
I know. And this was pre 9 a.m, right? And because 2 years ago, she came to one of my workshops and I referred her to a couple of people, and one of those people hired her and she's been in the role for 2 years and really loving it. And so she decided to give me a present. I was like, wow. And then I had a client board meeting at, was that just before this, about 3:45. And we made a lot of changes to board papers. And because of version control, there are a couple of errors I found out about yesterday in my board paper. And so the whole time I was thinking, oh, the board's going to tell me off for having a mistake in my pack. And that didn't happen at all. They were like, yep, great pack as always, you know, really good work. And it was all very positive. So I think that's just a story about my silly inner critic and what an idiot they are. But I went, oh, well, that went really well too. And now I'm talking to you.
There you go. Yeah, so it just gets better and better.
You can't beat it. You can't beat it. and happy Pride as well. It's Pride season up in Sydney. And you told me.
Absolutely.
You told me you marched in Mardi Gras on the weekend.
I sure did, Tash. It was, I marched in the parade, which was, it's something I like to do annually, you know, show my support, show my pride. And marched straight to bed afterwards because I knew I had a big week this week. So that's pretty much, most people think my march ended at the party or the after party. Mine ends with a cup of chamomile tea and in bed.
I actually saw a lot of that on Instagram because obviously I didn't go. I've got FOMO. And I saw a lot of people, probably because the people in our age group are people who went, yeah, a lot of people were going to Mardi Gras and then getting to bed at a reasonable time. But people also wanted to go to things the next day and they didn't want to be hungover. And so I do think, yeah, I don't think it's so uncommon for anyone maybe in their 30s or 40s or older.
I don't know about that. I had a lot more energy in my 30s for that kind of stuff. Yeah. But I think things change, and I think it's nice to have options. I think
if you want to wake up,
Sydney offers that. If you want to show your pride in different ways, there's so many different opportunities where you can champion your own pride. And it's wonderful living in a city that affords us those opportunities to do so.
Yeah, yeah. I can imagine Sydney would be an amazing place to be right now.
Yep.
Everything that's going on. We're not here to talk about pride for the whole time. Could talk about it for the hour. We're here to talk about change champions, pride and change champions.
There you go. Championing your pride.
Before we get into the topic of change champions though, there's two questions I ask every guest who comes onto the podcast. And the first question is, what are you currently watching, reading or listening to?
Oh, I love that. Besides listening to your podcast, of course, which we love. Let's start with watching. I'm a watcher kind of reader guy. So in terms of watching, and I know you're going to love this, I am hooked on The Last of Us.
Yes.
And you're feeling me? It's such
I have an
a
episode
good...
coming out tomorrow where I said that's what I was watching. So yeah, I'm super into it. Yeah. It's so good.
Yeah. And I'm obviously into it because it's wonderful to see the translation from the video game. I'm a huge gamer. I probably learned DOS before I could speak English, just so I can play video games on my PC when I was a young kid. And it's a really great show. I mean, I love anything that is a bit post-apocalyptic and just deals with how humans respond relationship-wise and, encounter not just the change, but encounter each other and behaviors that maybe aren't as sort of human when, you know, when all things are going well and the world's working perfectly. And I think a lot of people can relate to that right now.
Yeah. I mean, I would like to think if something like that did happen, we'd be a bit nicer to each other, because in the show there's a total breakdown of society.
Yeah.
Real. But really, I mean, it, and it happens so quickly as well. Like I do have a bit more of an optimistic view that maybe we would help each other out a little bit more and, you know, not be as nasty as some of the characters that you encounter in our shows.
I agree. I'm always hopeful, especially when I come into change projects, that, you know, humans will get it and do it. But then I see such a plethora of behaviors. So if I had to extrapolate that onto The Last of Us, I think, yes, I think there will be an aspect of people in society that would believe that, depending on where their consciousness sits. But then again, I come from Africa, so maybe I've been exposed more to people that are hungry, what happens when survival mode kicks in. And I've seen some really real things in that country that really helped open my eyes, that when things don't go well, when you start losing electricity, when you start losing water, when there's that level of poverty, a lot of our primal instincts kick in. So whilst I do have a lot of hope, and that's why I love The Last of Us, because underlying there is that hope you and I share, I think we also have to be a bit realistic that, you know, there will be aspects or elements of our society that might not appreciate the change in the same way. And this is probably where champions come in. Talking through our conversation is often that's the bridge between those who get that level of understanding versus those who are still resisting or struggling or trying to make sense of a reality in their own context.
Yeah, because some people, they get it. They just go, yeah, just tell me what I need to do. Yeah. And other people, they panic. They have an emotional reaction. All very normal. Yeah. I'm thinking of the first episode when, everybody panicked. And I was like, stop panicking. But who knows what you would do. Anything else that you're watching or reading? Because otherwise this could be the Last of Us podcast review episode.
Man. Well, if you ever do that episode or that panel, count me in. I think there's some good metaphors there. The other book I've picked up, I actually had a really good conversation with a guy named Declan Foster. He's been part of our Space for Change community, and we've been chatting on LinkedIn, and we had a conversation, but he sent me his book called Humology, which is how to put humans back at the heart of technology. And why I picked this up, aside from him having some really good, interesting things to say about change, I really am at a stage in my life and my career where I truly embrace that we can't really separate technology from people and our own humanity. And I think we have spent so much time focused on, and we spoke about this with CRMs, you know, customer relationship manager, about the tool, how it works, what AI it has in it. And sometimes we forget the question, well, who's the person we're trying to help with this? And I think as AI with ChatGPT becomes more prevalent and more accessible to the everyday user, I think it's an important conversation to really understand where the human side fits into this and how they're both so synonymous. So I love humans. I love technology. And I found Humology just brought them together quite nicely.
Amazing.
So, yeah.
All right, I'll make sure that's in the show notes so the listeners can check it out. Second question is, what was the best piece of career advice you ever received?
Oh, I love this one. There's so many coaches and mentors come to mind right now. But if I had to look at my life, where I was and where I am today, the best advice I would say is, someone once told me, if you're not on your own goal plan, you're on somebody else's. And that really woke me up, and really what he was trying to say to me was, if you don't have a vision for yourself, if you don't have a plan for yourself, for your career, you will land up at the whim of a lot of people with their own agendas. And the people that do have a clear objective, do have a clear way going forward. And I think this is quite interesting when it comes to change, because often we're exposed to so many different people's agendas, from the sponsor to the ops people to the front of house, wherever we might operate. We're quite lucky to operate in many different areas. And for me personally, I think that was a big piece of advice, because it made me realize I was spending so much time either trying to please someone or trying to get a job done without sort of thinking through the impacts or the change impacts, if you will, on who I am and what I want out of life. And it was that career advice that turned my whole life around, and I landed up going on my own with my own business. So, once I realized who I was, what did I want to get out of life, I think it was a really inspiring advice that I still hold to this day, that if I go into a change client every day, it's I think, well, what's my objective with this in terms of helping them? And are they clear on their own objectives? Because if we don't do that for change or for ourselves, we can go awry very, very quickly.
Yeah. 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 Because it's like, I know, I'm like, oh yeah, it's resonating so hard. Because yeah, like just on a project, I should say, is you need to check in and say, are we still doing what we set out to do? 100%. Oh, we've gone all the way over here. And you can do that in your life. You can go, oh, I'm living someone else's life. I'm living I've got someone else's career. I don't even want this career. Why am I doing? Yeah. Because other people have this expectation. Is it actually what I want to do? I don't think it is. Yeah. But you can get so very easily lost. Yeah.
You can get very, very lost with it. And I think ultimately, people with goals, people with plans out there are doing what they need to do to achieve that. And I think, if I think of my early career in change, I would get roped in trying to fix every problem out there. But if I just asked myself sort of, well, you know, what's my goal plan in this? It just made things hurt a little less. It made feedback a little bit more palatable if growth was my goal, as opposed to getting a job done. Oh, we're getting very philosophical. I love this.
That's great. That's great. We should talk about change champions though.
Yeah, agreed.
Because I saw you've posted a bit, not lately, because you're posting a lot about AI and chat GPT, I've seen.
Yeah.
But I have seen you posting a lot about change champions. And anyone who's listened this season knows I have a podcast idea wall. And it's got lots of sticky notes in it. So if I see something and I'm like, okay, well, I'm not doing the pod because I've had a big gap between seasons because it's busy. I put your name on the wall and went, well, because remember we tried to have a coffee, like a virtual coffee, and we couldn't make it work because we were both too busy. And I was like, I'd love to have Andrew on the podcast, but we need to meet first to make sure we have a rapport. Because I only interacted on LinkedIn. And then I finally had some time in January, I think. Oh no, it was December. Yeah.
It was December. Yeah, that's right.
And I was like, yeah, let's give this a go. And it happened. And I was like, yes, let's do it. But starting at the beginning, when should change champions be used or not be used? Do you have a view or advice that you would give the listeners on that?
That's a really great question. And the more I think about it, the more I get into a lot of the semantics around the word champion.
Yeah.
And I think we can use the word champions as a noun, for example, to describe a human that we have an expectation to assist us on a project to run the change through. But then we can also use it as a verb in terms of championing the change, in terms of really getting business to experience it, understand it, play with it beforehand. And a lot of this was inspired when I started my career. I transitioned out of finance, believe it or not. And I transitioned into a part of my career that was very much, I guess, focused on learning and development. Because in those days, listen to me, but it was a long time ago, maybe 20 years ago. But in those days, a lot of pressure was put into training people to just get the change done and do that. And I would often land up in a position where people would come in, I'd prepare all my learning content. I was really, really excited about it, really fully engaged to facilitate. And we never touched the learning content because people would be like, well, why am I here? What's this training? I don't understand. And it enlightened the question that we do need something before comms and training, before just telling people we're changing and do it. And that's where the word championing came up. It was the first time I probably used it all those years ago in that context, is we need something to champion the change before we put these poor souls into learning and development. And really, I looked at all the questions they were asking, and it was, why are we doing this? What's in it for me? All the typical stuff that now we consider just normal part of change. Mm. So I guess if we look at the verb, I do. I think all projects need championing. I think that's a huge part of our role, whether we do that ourselves, do it through the projects with sponsors, or have it through a change network. But I think the really interesting question I know you and I have touched base on before is, if we use it as a noun, then it becomes a little bit tricky. Then the question is, well, if we can all agree that all change needs championing of some sort and some degree as a verb, do we need the noun? Do we need a human with us doing that? And obviously you've touched on one of the topics very dear to my heart is AI, and where we're going now with ChatGPT and natural language processing is just incredible. And a huge question comes in, well, if that person is just doing X, Y, Z, can AI do it? And secondly, how do we make that role work so that the change is truly championed?
So
I think that's where we have the sticking point, is let's focus more. I think we can, most of us will agree that the verb of champion is non-negotiable. It's part of what we do. But the question I think is, do we need a champion, and where do they come from, and who are they, and what is it? I know conceptually a lot of traditional training companies might talk about you need a change champion network, but I think in practice, how that gets applied and when when the proverbial rubber hits the road, that's when the real juicy stuff comes into question. I mean, what have you seen from your side, Natasha, in terms
mixed of results? You were talking about, I feel like sometimes change champions, well, sometimes it's a great development opportunity and sometimes it's a poison chalice. It doesn't go well for the project or the champion. And there's a lot of factors that come into play. But one thing that you said that I wanted to touch on was, you know, you talked about that example of it's only when people get into training that they actually have the opportunity to ask, what is this change and why are we doing it? And you're like, oh, but I'm all the way down here trying to show you how to use the new system, or like you've assumed that they already knew that and they didn't. And I feel like sometimes champions can get lumped into that, and I'm using air quotes, comms and training kind of.
That's it.
They get commsed at, or people say, oh, we've got a champion network, but we didn't actually empower them to do anything, or we just talked at them and we only gave them one-way communication. We didn't actually take on any of their opinions or even ask for their opinions. I'm getting way ahead of myself. I'm starting to rant. So I feel like too often they can actually get kind of smooshed into that just comms box.
You got your champions. And I think we've got a risk with sponsors of change, that they might assume if I nominate somebody and they're the champion, that it'll all take care of itself. If I then put that into the future in the next 5 years, our sponsors now going to say, oh, well, you've got ChatGPT, you don't need champions. And I think there's a perception out there that really hinges on maturity. And when I say maturity, there's change maturity, but there's also HR and people maturity within the organization. So I agree with you. I think everyone knows we need championing it, but what does that look like if we were to get a network of champions? And I don't think every project needs it. I don't think every change needs it.
No.
But I also think a lot of the work that we do at Earth to Mars, we have found that there is possibility to develop natural champions. So just like this world of social media that naturally attracts people around a course and naturally regulates itself and gives feedback and do that, we put that hypothesis into a lot of our change clients that we work with. And it's amazing what is possible if you start looking beyond just, I'm going to nominate people and just have them as champions, in terms of creating that natural edge. So I think there's a lot of things we can touch on in this episode around change champions. And I think it's sort of looking at the one side of the spectrum, which is probably the invisible champion, where the project team and us, you and me, are doing all the work behind the scenes. Before it goes live or goes into training or goes into some kind of a support and business as usual. I think on the other side of the coin, you know, we've seen very mature clients we've worked on that have front of doors where the business is so involved in change that they can go, actually, no, this is not the right time. You can almost like a air traffic controller, and they can say, well, no, you can't do that. And obviously that's in quite large organizations, and they decide what change goes when and why and how. And then in the middle is this beautiful area to play with in terms of, you know, some of the mixed bag of chips we've seen.
So let's come back to maturity for a second. So how does change maturity influence the success of a change champion network, or de-influence if it's like...
I think we can look at maturity. I love this question because the word maturity gets thrown around a lot. And I mean, I remember using it when I first got to Australia, and a board of directors actually got offended. When I sort of said, you know, what's your HR maturity? And they're like, how dare you? And so that made me really go in depth to really understand what maturity might mean and how to position it better. So I'm a huge fan of Paul Kurtz. I mean, he's done some really, I'm a fan of a lot of people, but yeah. I really like his definition of maturity, because we can, something I've seen from a lot of experience is if we're talking about maturity as purely they don't get change, I think that's an opportunity to show them how to do it right and to do it well. And obviously there's some conditions to that, but I really think the clients that I've worked with that don't understand change sometimes are some of my best clients, because they're a little bit more open.
They're a little bit more like, when people
how
have,
do you do it? Tell me how.
Yeah. And when people have preconceived ideas of how it should be, that's when you can run into problems. Because I find that with, you know, because I'm an agile enthusiast, if I'm working in environments that are very like waterfall wedded, they're like, no, we will not do a change canvas. It has to be a change plan. Whereas if I'm going into an organization that has low change maturity, they're like, this is great. Let's give this a go. This is what we want. This is why we've asked you to come here. And they're very open to it. And I also feel like just because an organization doesn't have a change practice or 400 change managers running around, they can still be very good at doing change if they have, you know, the right culture and the right attitude and they go about things in the correct way. So anyway, back to you. Well, I interrupted.
And I love that point, is because we've worked with a client that had one change manager, and then the team was all people within the business. Cool. So we built that capability up there, and it worked in that situation. So love what you're saying. I think when we talk maturity, I think it's okay in terms of understanding of change. And what I find with super change mature clients, sometimes there's a risk there of lip service. So, the tick box says we need champions. Okay, so just nominate. So there's risks on both levels. I talk about it more around HR maturity. And there's a really good session we did with one of my mentors. We've got it recorded on Earth to Mars TV, and we'll talk about that at the end. But he really introduced me to Paul Kearns's understanding. And it's just two things. And yes, you can assess it and get all scientific, but it boils down to two things to make it simple for anyone who's a change leader. Is maturity around people has to do with, firstly, your executive's perception of people. Now, isn't that interesting? It's not about necessarily how much change you do, which methodology you use, which tools are you in there, how big is your change team, which I think a lot of humans get preoccupied with. It's about perception. And what he really said is, if your executive does not see value in people, you're going to have a really hard time, not just with change, not just with learning, not just with comms, but a really hard time developing that community. Because that will pervade through the organization. And often I turn down clients if I don't see that basic commitment to people and basic commitment to understanding the impacts on them and helping them through it. And this is often why people stay in organizations, is because they can still go through change at whatever pace, but they looked after it. There's a two-way conversation. So if you don't have if your executive sort of sees people as just, there's a number, it's something to be paid, and whatever I say, they need to do it. That's when I've had the most struggle setting up a change. So that would give you a low maturity. And obviously the other end of maturity, there's two things Paul Kearns says, is capability. Because you might have an executive that gets people, understands change. But if your change managers, leaders, project team are not showing up, not just with skills in their domains that they're continuously learning, but an actual appreciation on how to set up a community for success, it becomes quite dangerous, because they might then say, we got this change manager doing it, and you show up and it all falls flat and we don't necessarily have it. And I think there's a lot that I've realized that I think a few of us might do naturally, but a few of us it's not natural to when setting up that champion. So again, it goes to what is your goal plan with those champions And what is, how does that go to it that really affects it ultimately? But if we look at maturity on those two levels, I think that's how it affects change champions, is if you're going to have a real hard time trying to get people up out of their day to day, if you've got an executive that thinks, oh, well, I just tell people what to do, or your team doesn't really have the skills to build that network effectively.
Yeah.
And there's a third one that he doesn't mention, but I like to add it in. The third one is becoming way, way more real now with the accelerated rate, but I also think it's capacity.
Oh, yeah.
Is so many people
such
like
a problem.
So I extend this to say, well, you've got to actually look at those three things when it comes to not just change, but really looking into whether a change network would work, is the maturity, the perceptions, the capability, but also the capacity. Like you can have incredible champions selected in part, but if they don't have capacity, or your audience doesn't have capacity to engage with your champions, it becomes an issue. So a lot of the projects now, we're actually doing assessments of people's capacity at their stage to actually see the success of change.
Same.
Not just the executives, not just you as well.
Because this is where it heads into poison chalice territory, is if people, you know, you've got to sit, let's say hypothetically, and this is a situation everyone's experienced if you've worked in change, you've got a situation where you're trying to stand up a network. You say, yeah, I want people who are really enthusiastic, you know, good attitude, it's a good development, blah, blah, blah. You do the pitch, you get nominated, some really amazing high performers get nominated, but then they don't get given any time, they don't get less work, they're not enabled to take time away from their day job to participate in the project.
Absolutely.
So then it becomes, you know, a burden on them. They've been rewarded for good performance with more work. Then it's not part of their KPIs, or like they're not being recognized formally for this work in any way. And, you know, they start to resent it. Or then the other thing is, you know, their managers are saying, hey, I need you to do XYZ day job BAU. And because that's what their managers are telling them to do, they're doing it. So then they're not showing up and they're not putting in the effort. So I feel like that's, and then it just all falls over, because it's like, well, I'm not these people's manager. You know, I can't tell them you must do this. But yeah, I feel like that seems to be a situation that happens a lot, and it's not fair on the people. And then they don't want to put their hand up to be change champions anymore because they got burnt last time.
Yes.
You know, and then
so it goes from a chalice to a wheel of terror.
Yeah, self-fulfilling prophecy of change terror. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's why some people might not like the term change champions. And
I
can
avoid using
that.
It. I avoid using it. I'm like, let's have ambassadors or influencers. And I know influencer has, it's a loaded
Even
term
worse.
Too.
Look, aww. We can stick a Band-Aid on it. I think changing the name's a nice Band-Aid, but in the end of the day, we've got to get back to the purpose of it. And I think it's a really strong case to earn that trust and get involved upfront. Because, you know, if we're co-creating a change strategy with the business and their stakeholders, like, this is the type of stuff you flesh out upfront.
Yeah, and you've got to say, yeah, we need people from the business.
We need a backfill.
Is there budget? Can we second people from the business into the project? Like, can we pay people, you know, if they need to spend 5 hours a week on this, can the project fund that? So we don't have this rub with business units where they're asking for time. I'm having the, because I didn't actually finish, I just told the story and went, oh, when it goes bad. I'm having those conversations with clients about, well, this is what it takes. And, you know, the payoff is, you know, you have people co-design and involved. We all know, I said this a million times, the change will manage itself. Like, you won't be controlling the change. You'll be facilitating it.
That's
because you got the right people on board. People won't be taking that victim mentality of I'm having it done to me and therefore I'm mad about it because I wasn't consulted. Because it does take time and money. Like, it's, you know, and I think we kind of segged into my next question, which is, you know, what are some things that can go wrong when you're standing up a change champion network? But yeah, like, it can be seen, it's often seen as a blocker. Like, change overall is often seen as a blocker by people because you're like, oh, I want to train people. I want to write some comms. I want to stand up a network. They're like, you can't do that. Go live in 4 weeks. I'm like, well, these are the things that you asked me, what will successful change look like? And, you know, and then it's like, well, if we're going to do all of that, that's going to take ages. So, you know, again, people see that as a blocker, and it's like, well, you want to do it properly, this is what you need to do. If it is the right change, as you quite rightly pointed out.
Absolutely. And I mean, you're touching on probably my favorite way of approaching change is with co-design, is with using human-centered design, using the amazing technology we have at our fingertips to really move. And we spoke about this at one of our events this week, is we spoke about moving away from this hierarchy of people into more of a hierarchy of ideas. And we're doing this in our personal lives with social media, with a lot of things that we're already doing in terms of voting. But this is the power that we can harness within organizations, is we find that co-creating it with people and getting a good diverse cross-section, you not only get better ideas, you not only, I guess, filter out those things that will not work for us, but you also build natural champions. Because you're not really asking someone to fill a role and be a champion. You're asking them for inputs into how they want to go through the change with you. Little sneak peeks in things like that. And all of these things can be used quite intentionally to actually develop champions out of people quite naturally. So whilst Agile, I think, creates a good environment for it, I think the skill of human-centered design and the skill of collaborative technology bring that to life in change. And I always challenge... And if I am dealing with a traditional organization, I mean, I won't necessarily call it all of those fancy words, but within those waterfall, find opportunities to actually say, I'm going to workshop this. Yeah. And then just arrive and just say, I need a cross-section. So that would be probably the included. And I, you know, in my head, there's probably 5 or 6 levels of change champions. And I think that would be on the upper end, is where you are naturally creating champions by co-creating the change with people. I think there's an opportunity for people in technology to really do Agile properly and for change to work well with technology developers or whoever the vendor is developing the technology, to actually put people through both those cycles of Agile development and true engagement there, and use the same people on the project in terms of how we co-create the change and what their needs are.
Yeah, very good. So what do you think are some traps for new players? Because this is, you know, you go into an organization, they say, oh, maybe do we need change champions? You're like, yeah. And you go about standing it up. Like, what are some traps? Do you have any experiences that you've learned from that, you know, or advice that you would give to someone who's going into this for the first time?
I have, and I don't think it's just people going into this the first time. I think there's a lot of people with a lot of experience that still sprout theoretical concepts and hold them so true until something really, really bad happens and you go, holy crap. So I think the first trap is, yes, there's a lot of theory out there. There's a lot of templates. There's some businesses will say, oh, you know, I listened to Tasha's podcast on champions, we need change champions. And that's the new shiny thing. And that can be a potential pitfall, because if we're not asking, well, why, what purpose would that change champion serve? We've actually missed the boat. Yep. And we might land up doing more damage than we actually do. So my first thing I would avoid is, don't worry too much about the theory. Whilst it's great to understand concepts and have beautiful discussions like this, I think ultimately every project's different. I think every change is different. And you don't have to throw the champion card up front.
No.
I think there's tremendous advantages of it. If you want to scale change, for example, and it's just you or just a small team, I think just like you would scale your business, I think this is an opportunity to scale your change and amplify what you're doing. But they need to be managed as a community. So 2 is avoid the checklist. I think people think it's, oh, you know, this methodology or our approach says we need champions and we need to select them. I think that's where we do the most damage.
Yeah.
Because we call this, it's probably one step ahead of the invisible change champion. And some projects go great with an invisible champion. But we call it tokenistic champion.
Yeah.
We find the person on that, we just ask the question of business, hey, who can we nominate as champions? And they go, oh, great, I need to get that email done. Let me just give you the person on the bench. And I think where the pitfall is, if we haven't onboarded properly, if we haven't recruited properly, and I think this is where you can put your traditional HR hat on. is think about it like a life cycle of an employee. You've got to start with recruitment, and we've got to be clear on that job description.
Mm.
And what are the skills? What are the, you know, whilst we will pick up champions in our stakeholder mapping, I think we need to go deeper and say, well, what are the human skills there? What are the technology skills? What are the operational skills? Firstly, and secondly, if we move away from hierarchies of people into hierarchies of ideas, well, whose ideas are people listening to in the organization? Because you might have a position quite higher, but you might have a lot of influence and not have that position.
Yes.
Because you're a team leader in a call center, and yeah, you are pretty much the be all and end all for your team on a day-to-day basis. So I know in call centers, for example, those team leaders become so, so important,
yeah,
in that championing. So tokenistic champion, I think we need to really watch for is, yeah, we just have a champion, we've nominated them, and we put them in training the week before we train everybody else.
Yeah, that, and we do the lip service one-way comms, yes, and we go, we've got this champion. And
super.
Yeah. I think also flowing on from that, it is not just tokenistic champions, but the wrong champions. So you've got to be, yes, really clear when you're working with your business, especially if they're not sure on the concept, about making sure, because like you said, you got to find people who are actually influential. Like maybe somebody's a really hard worker, or they're a subject matter expert, but are they actually, are they the right person to champion, like the verb, yeah, like you said before? And there's another one that I've been burnt by, or I've had mixed results, but there, and I'd like to hear your opinion on this, is what do you think about when people say, oh, we want a detractor in the champions group? Because I, you know, I'm all for, like, for change. We can't get enveloped by toxic positivity, and we do need to speak to detractors and understand them. But I'm unsure if having them in a group of very positive people as, you know, the token detractor is the right idea. And then there's also, yeah, tokenistic in people getting voluntold. It's like, I don't want to be here, but my, yeah, manager told me I had to do it. It's like, yeah, well, don't be here. Please go away.
Yeah, don't waste your time. I love that. And I was actually thinking the same thing. And in fact, I was going to say one of the pitfalls would be not to include a detractor.
Yeah. So I wanted to say, what's your opinion on that? Because
I've had mixed experiences, but overall, it's always been a good thing for me, because if you're truly going to test your change and your thinking and what you're putting down for people to pick up, I would rather have a detractor in the room, because if we can convince them, and that's probably another pitfall, if we're not truly onboarding them,
yes,
putting them in specific milestones way before training happens or way before go live happens, I think we've lost the plot, because I want to hear the detractor not at the end. I want to hear the detractor in the beginning.
Yeah. I think when you have a detractor who also has a really good attitude and is very passionate about the project and their work, then it works. Where you have a detractor who is just someone who's miserable and grumpy and has a shitty attitude, then you're not going to get the results, because that person is a detractor for everything. Yeah. They're not actually somebody who's proactively troubleshooting and pointing out problems. So I think I thought through my own comment during the conversation, and because, yeah, I've had mixed results, and I agree with you 100%. We can't only have speak to people who agree with the change, because then you're going to get a nasty surprise. Like, we've got to work that shit out during the
process. Yeah, 100%. You know, but you can also involve them at specific parts. Like, you might not involve them in ideating, because all ideas are literally born drowning. You don't want the detractor putting the idea down and drowning the poor thing.
Yeah.
But they're really involved in, well, how would that land with their team? What are we missing here? So I think you can be quite artful at what stage. And if I go back to the example of thinking through it, I think we need to recruit them, have a good job description. We need to onboard them properly. What is your role? Yes. What isn't it? But also, we can involve them in process design.
Yeah.
Even if it's just walking through the process and what are your thoughts?
Yeah.
We can involve them in those playbacks in Agile. Why are we not involving them there and getting their input?
And showcasing. Get them showcasing and saying what they've done.
Exactly.
And
getting them testing your system. I can't believe
how
many technology testers are there, and they just put a list of names for testers instead of thinking, well, these are the people that are going to give you input into that.
I've had that happen where I've had a champions group, and I've said to the champions group, you're going to help test the system. And then all of a sudden, you know, the testers are like, oh, we've, you know, gone and got some people, or we need people. I'm like, the champions. That's what they're for, you know.
Bingo. So that's how you can actually sell that value in. So champions are not made overnight. And I think that's the pitfall, is giving someone a title, making them happy, all that kind of stuff is not enough. I think we need to involve them at strategic points in the project, whether it's agile, wagile, whatever it is. And most organizations have a hybrid where they use agile for discrete development and good old waterfall to report upwards. So I'm very au fait with that. So having that journey becomes really, really important, and designing it around them. But again, the question of time is going to come up. Yeah. So if you haven't really done a good strategy in terms of change, and you just sort of come in towards the end and you're thrown in this and they say, just do it, that's where we lose the opportunity. Is I find that the sooner, the place that I start this conversation is after the stakeholder mapping.
Yeah.
Because if you've got people that are highly impacted and highly influential, that's your pool. It's not to say everyone's a champion, but that's where I look for those people. And after that, immediately, I'm like, well, let's talk about this in reality. How much time? And clients that backfill have the best results. I mean, this is no different than putting a subject matter expert in. And you don't have to do it full time either. And designing it how the project works, I think really hooking it into those things. Oh, when's the process maps going to be ready? Great. Let's involve them. Oh, you don't do them. Great. We'll come and co-design that with you. But involve them there. I think definitely in the system and the technology, seeing what it might be. I think people's fear might also be, but we don't want to over-consult. We just want to get this done. You don't have to take on everyone's feedback. And I think that's the misconception I get. And the pitfall that I think a lot of people in change fall into is, oh, the executive said that, no, we need to do this, we can't consult, so we just do it. But I think we underestimate how much time that actually requires.
Yeah.
So I think getting a whole bunch of feedback doesn't mean you as an executive or you as a change project needs to implement it. I think all people need is a reason why you're not. And when you start having that two-way conversation between your champions and the executives with you as change, as the facilitator of that, it's magical. And I find even the detractors go, okay, well, you've heard me. And this is the exciting thing about detractors, is if you involve them in a process and take them through that process as opposed to trying to convince them. One, it's important to make them feel heard.
Yes.
And I think two, it's important to close the feedback loop, because the detractor is going to do worse for you. If you tell a detractor, we're not doing it, but this is the reason.
Yes.
It's so simple. It costs nothing. And I'm getting manic with you right now.
But so am I, because I'm like, because people get mad when they give feedback and you don't take it on board, but you don't tell them why. So they think, I've been ignored. All you have to do is say, that was a great feedback point.
We heard it.
I'm not going to incorporate your feedback. And this is the reason why. Does that seem okay? And they usually go, okay, you've explained that to me, I understand. So they've given the feedback. Like, you don't, it's not mandatory that every piece of feedback has to be taken on board. You can say, that's great feedback, but you know, it doesn't align with this or that, or we discussed it, but then, you know, we decided that it wouldn't work with this. Like, there are so many reasons why you actually can't take, or you can say, that's great feedback, but unfortunately it's just really expensive to do, so we'll put it on the backlog. You know, so we'll have a discussion about adding that as a feature at a later date. But if people, like, you just need to close that loop, but so many people don't do it.
Just treat people like people. Like, if you were in their side and you gave feedback and your time, reward them with an answer.
I get annoyed when I do reviews and then I see the updated version and I'm like, none of my feedback has been incorporated. And you didn't have a conversation with me to explain why you weren't incorporating it. That's
and
we're
paid for it. Imagine being taken out of your normal job.
But so then
to catch that up. Yeah.
What happens there is, you know, this is another vicious cycle, right? Is the change champions get brought on board. They give feedback. The feedback's ignored. And then the change champions are kind of
dead in the water.
Poorly labeled, because it's like, well, you were a part of this project. Why did it turn out so shitty?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, well, I wasn't listening to.
Dead in the water.
Another trap for a new player that I wanted to bring up, because it popped into my head when you were talking before, and it's popped into my head with another thing that you've said, is as a change manager, you've got to protect your time and your sanity. So if you're in that minimum viable product for change situation where you've been brought in late, you don't think you have the time or the resources to stand up a change champion network, don't do it to yourself. You have to protect your energy. And, you know, you may need to explain, like, if you had brought me in 6 months ago, I would have loved to have stood up a change champion network for you. But because you've brought me in with 4 weeks to go, we have to talk about minimum viable product. And Change Champion Network is not part of that, because you've got to remember. Yeah. And the other trap around that, you're protecting your energy, is sometimes it can become bigger than Ben-Hur, right? Even if you've got the time. So maybe it's a really big project and you've got a lot of things to do on your plate, and maybe standing up a huge Change Champion Network and running Train the Trainers with them and turning them all into super users, maybe it's not going to be physically possible for you to do that. So you've got to think about that as well, because then it becomes your thing, because you're the change manager. It has change in it. You have change in job title, like, it's, and everything becomes your job relating to that network, and it can become quite cumbersome, right?
So don't overcomplicate.
Yeah.
So I loved your points about coming in last minute. I've been in that situation a few times.
Yeah.
And yeah, it can rub some hairs the wrong way with some people. But I just say, look, we need a focus to go live. But what if we then invest the effort post-go live?
Yeah.
And that's where you start building a network of people. The second response to that is, well, does every champion need to be a super user? Does every champion need to be trained the trainer? And, you know, we're in a world of technology and hyper-connectedness, you can scale quite nicely being on your own. But I do think we need to do this with the business. And not having that insight, not having that checking board, can be quite lonely as well. I'm a big supporter of managing our energy as well. And I found that one of the most important parts, like, if I was going to drop stuff, I would probably drop the FYI comms. I might drop the steer code, and I might even, I think training can take care of itself if you do that well. But the one thing I won't do in change is drop engaging the people that are highly influential and highly impacted, because they've got stories to tell. They're connected to people who listen to those stories. Mm. And I really think bringing them along, if you just do that and not call it championing, you've gone a long way. In fact, I think if you set up a properly scaled practice, you're probably spending more time with your champions and less time writing the comms and
sitting
sorting
in
out
cross-functional stream meetings. Yeah.
100%. And this is why I love, you know, the human-centered design element. I'm not going to say human-centered because everyone thinks they are, but the actual skill of facilitating people as a community really is impactful. And I think if you do a really good job there, you can use them as a tester, makes it less lonely. You can use them to help you develop. You can use them to review learning content instead of making them the trainer. And there's so many different ways to learn. So I would say championing change as a verb is probably the one I won't compromise.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Great. So what's your vote? Is Change Champion a poison chalice, or is it a development opportunity? What do you think?
For me, it's a development opportunity for myself, for the project, but also for the people there. I think if you use it as lip service, absolutely, it's detrimental.
I think when done correctly, absolutely, development opportunity.
And
done really badly, poison chalice.
Yeah, but it doesn't necessarily have to be how you imagine it. It's just me and all these champions around it. Sometimes it can be really, really simplified. Sometimes it's just showcases. So it goes back to my original example. The question is, what can you give your change champions that will help them and their teams not ask all those questions in training?
Yeah.
And feel comfortable during go live and beyond. And if you can do all of that and involve them in that sense and answer those questions simplistically, I think you've got a recipe for success. You know, I think there's a lot of detractors around Change Champions. There's a lot of big scale projects I've done without champions, but we held very powerful design thinking workshops around co-creating a narrative, around co-doing the stakeholder map. So instead of, and I've had this with a lot of the finance companies we've worked with, where they just, you arrive on day one, here's a list of 5,000 people, Andrew, do your stakeholder map and tell us the answer at the end of the day.
God.
That's the trap you don't want to fall in. And that's the opportunity to go, well, I can do it, but I don't know anybody here.
Yeah.
Or I can involve some people that really have an understanding of yeah. this change impacts on people, and let's co-design it with them.
Yeah.
And that's where I'll pull up a good old stakeholder map and either do it on a Miro board or actually yeah. practically go and flip chart that. So I think it can be a poison chalice if it's not used with the right intention and it's not thought through strategically. And if it's not going to support your project and you've got 2 weeks to launch this, don't go down that rabbit hole. I loved your advice on that is, you know, if you're going to do it with meaning, do it with purpose, and make sure, because these people might actually be your champions on the next project if you stay within the organization.
Yeah.
So it's for me, it comes down to that skill of community management. You need to be able to facilitate a group. You need to be able to not just design that community, but be able to engage that community. And I think if you're building your skills in not just how to engage digitally, but also how to actually facilitate that kind of community, I think the rest takes care of itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Hear, hear. Where can people get more, Andrew, Earth to Mars? I know you've got a course coming up in March, end of March.
We do. Yeah, we do. So best way to get a hold of us, check out our website, www.earthtomars.com.au. We have a great course that is all about creating champions naturally with your business. It takes you through design thinking. It takes you through technology that we use at all our clients, and that's available, and also the human skills that we need to do it. So details on the website, you can reach out to the team. I'm on LinkedIn as well. I love LinkedIn. That's how we met.
Your LinkedIn content is great.
Thank you.
You're always starting really, really good conversations on there. Yeah.
Oh, that's what we love. And likewise, I feel I can give you the same feedback. So Andrew Buter. And the third is join our LinkedIn group, Space for Change. So Space for Change is a group where we actually all vote on topics that are relevant. And we actually, we've been doing it for about 2 years and we meet monthly-ish. Mm-hmm. I'm also managing my energy. And like the last one was last week. We spoke about AI versus human intelligence and neurodiversity, and it was all voted by the group. And the third is we've got a channel on good old YouTube. So if you want to catch up on past Space for Change, we put all of them up on Earth to Mars TV, Earth with the number 2.
Okay.
So that's how I'd engage. Check it out if you'd like some late night viewing.
I will.
Mardi Gras.
Come home from Mardi Gras and just unwind with a bit of Space for Change. I'll put links to all of those in the show notes. But yeah, definitely hit up Andrew on LinkedIn. You're always starting really good conversations and asking really interesting questions. It's very different to some of the usual LinkedIn stuff you see out there, because there's a bit of chaff, and you're definitely,
and there's a bit of cringe as well.
Talk
to me about cringe.
Yeah, but your stuff is great, so give Andrew a follow. And is there anything else you want to share with the listeners before we wrap up the podcast?
I think this is such a fantastic podcast. I listened to a couple of previous ones and I love what you're doing. So I want to not just share that with your listeners, but also with you. Please keep doing what you're doing. I see a lot of the passions that I have in my heart reflected in you. And this has been just so wonderful talking to you. Thank you for the experience.
Oh, that's wonderful. And thank you for coming on as a guest. And for the listeners, this is the final episode of season 7. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I feel like this is the most organized season I've ever done because I had 9 months to plan it. I might be back in October with another season, but I'm going to have to see how the year goes, because like Andrew said, I'm protecting my energy. But thank you so much for listening, for supporting, for telling your friends about the podcast. And Andrew, thank you for being our guest on episode 10 and being the final guest of the season. What a banger.
Oh, I feel so special. Thanks for that.